Hi there, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. My name is Lee Mottershead and I have news for you. The news is the top hats and the fancy frocks have been put away for another year because Royal Ascot is over, but not on this programme, because on this programme we're going to be talking about five fantastic days at Britain's premier racecourse. Joining me to do so, first of all in the studio, is the multi award winning
Steady
Chris Cook.
Hiya.
Did you have a good week?
Very enjoyable, yeah. Royal Ascot is like, it's become the most reliable thing in horse racing, hasn't it? You know, every year.
Yeah.
Great competitive racing, high quality, you know, unpredictable at times. And this year, you know, we had the weather. You know, it's just exactly what Royal Ascot should be. You know, lovely sun, but not too hot, so that
we're not
feeling punished under it. You know, those of us that have to be there day after day.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, you know, stories from left and right, it was excellent.
What about you, DJ? You were there across the week. You've been coming for the last few years. Where would Ascot rank in your favourite meetings that you attend during the year?
Oh, two, definitely two. I'm one of the surviving members of the Cheltenham number one fan club. I absolutely adore Ascot, but you just don't get the same sort of butterflies going through on Tuesday as you do for, you know, the Tuesday at Cheltenham. But a fantastic meeting. I always think it's hilarious to look at social media throughout the course of the week. So you see big punters are certainly people who proclaim to be big punters on social media, and they give out about Cheltenham because it's too predictable, and then they give out about Royal Ascot because it's too unpredictable. So I'm not quite sure where the happy medium is.
Right.
Maybe it's York Zebra meeting or something, but
no,
yeah,
that's not it.
I just think
York is very hard.
It's fantastic, and a shout out to Chris Dickles and all the team at Ascot, because I know there was far more winners on the straight course drawn high than low, but then the Wokingham winner comes out yesterday and wins out of stall one, and I think we can all agree there was no real massive draw bias as we've had in recent years at Ascot. So yeah, kudos to all the team there for getting it spot on.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And Christian, they had to water through the week. They did water through the week, but I didn't hear any complaints about the state of the ground.
No, I mean, it was, they said it was going to be quick and it turned out to be quick, but it, you know, not so fast that it was putting people off running.
Yeah.
Yeah, they absolutely did. It felt like, you know, they had to keep watering it just a bit every night, just to keep it on the right side of falling onto the wrong side, as it were.
And in general terms, before we look at the performances, taking the meeting as a whole, attendances were up a bit every day. The mood seemed very good.
I mentioned
my column today. There seemed to be a lot of positivity around the meeting, where there perhaps was more negativity surrounding this year's Cheltenham Festival. As a whole, it seemed to be a big win for the sport last week.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I would still have liked more people there. You know,
yeah,
when you love something so much, you know, you want everyone to enjoy it and to respect it as much as you do. So I think particularly on Tuesday and Wednesday, if you were wandering around the betting ring, like the traditional betting ring area in front of the stands, you might think, you know, this used to be a bit livelier years ago. People's betting habits are changing. You know, it's not the same as it was. So I felt a bit for your standard racecourse bookies. But attendance numbers went in the right direction a bit, and hopefully that will be a trend that's going to establish itself in the years to come. You know, the way people are feeling just now, money's tight. You know, it's always going to be difficult getting them to commit to spending the sort of money that you would need to get through the gates of Royal Ascot.
Yeah, and they did, a couple of years ago, they did put new crowd limits as well during the meeting. That kicked in, I guess, on the Saturday. And certainly there was a case a few years ago when Ascot was really, really busy, that there were just too many people there. I think this year, the Saturday felt busy, but it felt manageable.
Well, I wasn't on the Saturday, so I have to take your word on that. I don't remember feeling at any stage last week that it was overpacked.
No.
You know, for the people who were there, it was really comfortable. And you know, that's always the benefit if you show up, right? And,
yes.
And the crowd is maybe a bit lower than you were expecting. You get straight to the bar or whatever, and you can move around easy. But I think, you know, those of us who love racing, like it to be just, you know, 10% more popular next year.
Yeah, that's fair, Paul. Fair call. No one will be complaining about that. Okay, we are going to get into the meat of our discussion about the 5 days of Ascot in a second. But first of all, a quick break. Okay, welcome back to the Royal Ascot Review edition of The Front Page. We're going to be looking at the top and sometimes the not so good performances during those 5 days, looking at the horses, the jockeys, the trainers and the owners as we go through the programme. We're going to start with the horses, and I have picked out the three performances or three horses that maybe struck me most during the week, and this will lead into a wider discussion about the equine highs and lows during Royal Ascot 2024. And I'm going to start by talking about Kyprios, who won for me what is still the signature race of the Royal Meeting, and long may that be the case, the Gold Cup. It sits right in the middle of the programme, and it's still a race that I think has a tremendous aura about it. But in its 217-year history going into Thursday's edition of the Gold Cup, it only had two horses who had ever regained it. One back in the early days of the race, and one more recently at the turn of the century. Kyprios became the third. It might not have been a vintage Gold Cup, nor indeed a vintage Gold Cup performance, but in beating Trawler Man in a tremendous conclusion to the race, he really showed himself to be a horse not just brilliant but brave, in that last year he missed the Royal Meeting after an infection caused not just his career but his life to be under threat. He's come back from that thanks to great work from Aidan O'Brien and the veterinary team looking after the horse, and indeed the whole Ballydoyle. I thought his performance was tremendously laudable. Calandagan didn't win a Group 1 race. He won the Group 2 King Over the Seven Stakes on Friday afternoon. It was a record size field for the race, certainly in its modern era, with 14 horses taking part in the Ascot Derby. And I love the way Calandagan swept down the outside under Stefan Pasquier to beat a decent field by daylight. The sadness with Calandagan is that he is a gelding now. Not that the sadness that he's a gelding per se, but what that means, because it means not only can't he run in the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe later on in the year, he can't even go for the Grand Prix de Paris at Longchamp next month. So one wonders where his campaign will now lead. Hopefully it will begin by leading back to Ascot in the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes. And finally, I think you've got to go with at least one of the two Aidan O'Brien trained two-year-old fillies who lit up the track on Friday and Saturday, and a lot of people would have them as the top two of their equine performances list last week, just in terms of visual impression that they made. Bedtime Story was fabulous in the Chesham Stakes and could be a superstar of monumental proportions. But I'm going to go with Fairy Godmother, because I was bowled over by the way she managed to salvage success in the Albany Stakes on Friday. She came from nowhere. She was hampered at one crucial stage, made up a huge amount of ground under Ryan Moore, who did so while only riding her hands and heels. I thought she was a thrilling winner, and I would just pick out her over Bedtime Story as my top two-year-old filly. Okay, Chris, that's three horses I've mentioned. Well, four really, if you include Bedtime Story. But there are so many that you could say had great weeks at Royal Ascot. What struck you most?
Loads and loads. I mean, just before we get off Calandagan,
yeah.
I mean, you sort of watch that and think, well, he's got to come back for the King George, right?
Yeah.
But he's not in it. He'd have to be supplemented. But as you've
just
outlined, sure
they'd think about it, won't they?
Aga Khan can probably afford it. And they don't have all that many other options if he can't go for the Grand Prix de Paris.
Can't go for the Grand Prix de Paris. You could, I suppose, go for something like maybe the Grand Prix de... I don't know, three-year-olds, can they go in the Grand Prix de Saint-Cloud? I'm not sure they can. So,
I wish you hadn't asked me off the...
I don't think you can.
Off the cuff.
So, realistically,
the
in some ways, the summer highlight for him is easier than the autumn highlight, because the someone in some ways it's obvious it's the King George.
He's ready now, it's only next month, why not come back?
But then what do you do at the end of the year? Do you just work towards a Breeders' Cup Turf or a Champion Stakes, or do you go to Australia?
He's got Hong Kong as well, he could
Hong
run there.
And Hong Kong has had winners there, hasn't he?
The world's your oakster, as it were. But I mean, so I sort of all eager went online to see what kind of price he was being offered for the King George. Only 4-1 with Paddy Power Betfair. I mean, I no need for that, surely, when the connections hadn't even murmured the words King or George. I thought that was a bit tight, quite frankly. I see there's 8-1 elsewhere now. He's very exciting. I just wondered if the King Edward had maybe lost a bit of its status, you know, being bumped to the end of the card. Yeah. You know, that was a tiny bit disrespectful to the Ascot Derby, I thought.
Yeah, it was it's a recent trend. They tried to move some of the handicaps earlier into the card, I guess, to try and boost betting turnover.
Yeah.
But it does mean that the King Edward is quite late in the day.
I understand that instinct, but I'm afraid we've got to remember what the races that we're supposed to be focusing on are. I'd bring that one back more to the centre of the day. Anyway, Killandigan probably for me would be just about the most memorable winner. I think that race was 3 seconds faster than the Harwick, which was different days, so you know, not directly comparable. But if anything, the ground was supposed to be a bit faster on the Saturday, wasn't it? So I think that's a pretty serious effort. August Rudin, back to winning form again. He's so hard to predict, but it was really something for a Derby winner to come back and win the Prince of Wales over a shorter trip the next year. That's not usually attempted. It hasn't been done since Royal Palace, which is before I was born, you know. And it's increasingly difficult to say things in racing have happened for the first time since before I was born. So hats off to him. Asfura, you always love seeing, I think, an overseas winner at Royal Ascot, just for the encouragement that it gives to people to bring their horses from overseas to race at this meeting, which adds so much to it. I mean, it's always great when we get Irish runners and French runners, mm-hmm. but you can sort of take that for granted almost. When you get runners from Australia and America as well, that really makes it, that adds to the sort of exoticism of it. Even if you as a British punter, you're probably not tempted to back them.
And you do wonder as well, given that Asfura very much would not be regarded as the top of the sprinting pyramid in Australia, so much so that the connection was saying they had some criticism from back home for even bringing her across to Royal Ascot, like, in case they embarrassed the nation.
Yeah,
but the fact that she won, surely there'll be other connections in Australia thinking, my God, if she can do that, well, I know there's risks involved with a trip like that, but if Asfura can win that race, why don't we have a go?
If they feel like responding in that way, then great, good news for Royal Ascot, right? But I think the trainer was saying that, you know, there might have been reasons why that particular race suited especially well.
Yeah.
So he was giving British sprinting a bit of an alibi there. But there was a sort of feeling from the two big sprints of the week for the older horses that maybe that division is not at its absolute strongest in Britain just now.
No.
It was an 8-year-old Cardam that won on Saturday. I think I don't know when the last 8-year-old winner of that race was. Again, probably before I came along. So great horse Cardam, right? You know, everyone loves a horse like him that pops up. On one particular day every year. There's not much depth in that division.
No, and even today, the Commonwealth Cup was a pretty poor. And I know we'd lost Van Dijk and Bucanero Forte.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much. You're right, Inishan was a very good winner, but there wasn't much strength in depth of the race. But it didn't look to be anyway.
No, well, we'll find out more about what that form is worth in due course. I mean, I imagine he'll go for the July Cup. He's already favourite. It was interesting to me that, you know, with the 8 Group 1 races that we had over the week, like ordinarily you get maybe one clear winner, you know, the impressive horse that you take away from the week, you know, Frankel or something not quite as good as him. 6 of the 8 Group 1s were won by a length or less. So instead of having that sort of week of stars, as it were, we had really close competitive racing, which I must say would probably be my preference if you have to choose between the two.
Yeah.
The only two that won Group 1s by more than the length were Inisharan in the Commonwealth Cup and Sharon in the Queen Anne.
He was actually really impressive. He looks like the horse is getting better and better.
I mean, it was sort of hard to believe because he's been a little bit patronised, hasn't he, really?
Yeah.
You know, at the start of the season, we're like, oh, it's great, he's getting a couple of wins put together. Yes, in fairness to us, he did go through last year without winning a single race, although he was always running well. But he properly has morphed into something bigger and better than he was. You've got to be taken very seriously for all those good races now.
Yeah.
I mean, job done, in a sense, once you've won the Queen Anne. And he's had a few runs, so maybe they'll give him a break. But yeah, no more patronising for that horse.
No, definitely not. And certainly not for Rosalian DJ. It seems like a long time ago now, the St James's Palace Stakes, which was billed as the race of the meeting in some quarters. And, I mean, to do what he did off the back of runs in the Guineas and the Irish Guineas was was really impressive. That was a big performance, wasn't it?
It was. It was back in February, was it? feels like it was a lifetime ago, yeah. And we've had about a million races since then. But to me, he was the most talented horse that ran at Royal Ascot. I think it's very hard to do what he did against a horse of the caliber of Henry Longfellow, who got first run, who travelled beautifully, who had the run of the race, who kicked clear, and he still didn't win. And that was his ultimate target this season, Henry Longfellow. And he did everything right, ran a cracker, a career best, and still didn't win, and was beaten by a horse who was held up, who needed the gaps, who the jockey had ultimate faith in. I know I did, a few conversations on our morning show during the week with Johnny Dineen about this, and people were saying it was an unbelievable ride, whereas myself and Johnny were kind of saying, if he hadn't have won, you're given a very, very good horse like Henry Longfellow a big lead to try and make up, and it's a big risk. But I think Sean Levy, who is riding out of his skin, and I think it's great to see him, and even on JRB, I thought that was a terrific ride. I think it's great to see him having such confidence in the horse. And the point that everybody was making afterwards from the Hannon camp, be it Richard himself, be it Sean Levy and everybody around the horse, it's like, yeah, he won, and it's great, and it's the St. James's Palace Stakes, and he won the Irish Guineas, but by God, you guys haven't seen the best of this horse yet, because when he gets a proper pace and not a tactical scenario, he is going to come into his own. And I think that's the exciting thing. If he does go to the Sussex Stakes and he takes on Charon, and we do get pace in the race, and we know that Goodwood is very much a speed track as well, I think you're going to see Rosalian at his best. To me, he was the most talented horse to run at Royal Ascot.
Just on a related issue, if that race didn't pan out brilliantly for Rosalian, but he overcame it, I think that also feeds into Notable Speech. He was so, disappointing in that race, let's face it. He started 6-4 favourite. He was an unbeaten Guineas winner. Realistically, I don't think he was in the best place through most of that race, the way it worked out. Wasn't the strongest of gallops, and he was out the back and not really settling. Rosalian was able to overcome difficult circumstances, and Notable Speech just wasn't. And at just before the turn for home, I think he was about 2 lengths behind Rosalian, so he had a bit more to do, and he went wide instead of the sort of ground-saving route up the inner that Rosalian went for. So, yeah, he ran disappointing anyway, Notable Speech, and he didn't finish his race out. But in the circumstances, I think he was also given quite a lot to do, and, I'd be prepared to give him another chance.
I wonder, though, Chris, just looking back, and I wonder, did the fittest horse win the 2000 Guineas?
Yeah, that's got to be part of it, doesn't it? Yeah.
Mm. That's my fear with Notable Speech. He had the runs. He was running for the previous couple of months, and then he's beaten Rosalian, who's coming into the race as a season reappearance. I just wonder, was he the fittest horse? I think he's far more ability than he showed last Tuesday, but will he ever beat Rosalian again? I definitely don't think so.
Well, I wouldn't be betting him to beat Rosalian, but I'd be interested in him against almost anyone else. It'd be interesting if trainers took that message away from Notable Speech. Mm. Are we going to see the Guineas trials next year being taken more seriously? I mean, it'd be, from the point of view of a spectator, it'd be brilliant if races like the Craven and the Greenham were beefed up a bit.
The irony, though, is that as a stable, the Hannon team have often used the Guineas trials. They've been regularly.
Well, they did for Harton.
Yeah. And the Greenham too. DJ, what were your other sort of equine star performances from the week?
It's interesting you mentioned Bedtime Story and Fairy Godmother there. The most shocked I was for the whole week, for the 5 days, the most shocked I was Fairy Godmother, because it was an unrescuable, I don't even know if that's a word, situation. And it was gone, it was done, and she still managed to win. Now, people, it's funny that the argument afterwards seems to be who would you prefer for next year's Guineas, Fairy Godmother or Bedtime Story? And I kind of like that chat. I know people say it's nonsense, it's not till next May, but you have to talk about something, So I like people having an opinion, and the press room was completely divided. I know I spoke to Tom Siegel, and he was very much Bedtime Story, but it's still the Chesham, and I would always have, you just have slight reservations about the Chesham. I know, obviously, Pinatubo won it, and you have had good winners, but just this part of me that just thinks that maybe those that were 9.5 lengths plus behind Bedtime Story mightn't be absolute superstars, even though I know the Bowie camp think the world of the runner-up. But to me, Fairy Godmother, like, it's funny how winning changes everything, because you talk to anybody after the race or talk to or look on social media and all this kind of stuff, and it's like, oh my God, Ryan Moore, how did he do it? Like, and really, the reaction should have been, oh my God, Ryan Moore, how did you get yourself into such a mess? And you should be penning love letters to Fairy Godmother for the rest of your life, because anything that could have went wrong did go wrong. And she still won. And in fairness to Ryan, he said that after the race. He said, she got me out of a big hole here. To me, that was the one, oh my God, after the race. I know we were very much, oh my God, not to sound too much like Janice, but I know we were very much like that after Bedtime Story won by such a wide margin, and you're going, oh my God, she's after winning by 10 lengths or 9.5 lengths. But to me, it was the disbelief I had that Fairy Godmother managed to get up after all that went wrong. So for me, she would get the performance of the week for me.
DJ, just on the subject of the guineas, we've got to take into account, don't we, that Aidan has basically got out of the habit of winning those Newmarket Classics. I mean, as much as we think these are the best horses potentially going for the race that we know of already, are they going to be sharp enough for early May next year?
Well, I interviewed him before the Derby, and I asked him about his approach. I know our Ireland editor, Richard Forrester, wrote about this and how the change of approach from Ballydoyle in recent years has been maybe not to attack the early classics and the guineas as much as they used to. And I asked him about this, and his reply was that the calendar has gone so long that you're into your November, December. And he was even going towards kind of Maidan in February and March kind of a thing. Wow. He was including that in this year's calendar. And he said, you're compromising your chances of longevity throughout the season if you're having them ready to peak on the first Saturday in May, or as it can be, I think, can it be the last Saturday in April some years? And that would worry me if you're, and especially at the prices, like, you're talking 3-1 and 9-2 or whatever it is. Like, you're taking very skimpy prices about horses that are not going to be at the peak of their powers for the 1,000 guineas, right? Because the season is so long, and that's the thing that would be in the back of my mind. But you would be surprised. I know there's a lot of the season to unfold, but I think we'd all be very surprised if either one of the two didn't start favourite for next year's 1,000 guineas, given, you know, they stay sound.
And DJ, is there anything that's maybe less obvious in terms of the horses that ran last week that struck you or that you'd want to mention?
Yeah, I can give you a few unlucky losers if you want. That's the thing about Ascot. Like, you could, like, if you were to write down all the unlucky losers last week, you'd have a sore hand. Like, it's just, it's extraordinary. Like, I'll put them in maybe in what I saw. Well, the most unlucky loser and the horse who, without any shadow of a doubt, would have won comfortably without all that happened was Orazio in the walking. Like, that to me was not just the best horse in the race. Orazio could have won that race by 2 lengths if basically it wasn't an absolute horror show from start to finish. Like, so much went right. Like, it was incredible that Orazio got as close as he did. And another 15 yards, he would have won snugly, like, after meeting so much trouble. And he probably needs more cut on the ground. So to me, he's the one that, and it's frustrating because he started favourite so often in his career. He started favourite for the race last year, and he's never missed by punters. But this is one occasion where he started 16-1. He kind of was missed by punters. But what's going to happen now is, because he was so unlucky, he's going to start favourite for the Stewards' Cup again and all this kind of stuff. So, but to me, he was the one that should have won and should have won easily. A less obvious one to me, the best horse in the Coventry was Al Kudra for Godolphin. It wasn't that he got in awful trouble like Orazio or anything like that, but it was just when William Buick was starting to put the revs up, he just, either side of him, it was just a pure coincidence, the gap closed on either side. If one side had to come in, it would have been fine, or the other, it would have been fine. He was just making his move. To me, he lost 2 lengths, and he was beaten one. That was one that got away, I'd say, for William. I thought he was the best horse in the Coventry. So there's another one. Can I think of any more? Obviously, the main one that people would be writing down would be King's Gambit, who was set an almighty task and just didn't manage to reel in JRB. I don't like favourites in races sitting so far back, and not even favourites, but real fancied runners. I know you can say that King's Gambit was slowly away and his hand was kind of forced, but even going back to Inspiral in the Prince of Wales, like, you can't. I don't think you can win races being 20 lengths behind after two furlongs. These are high quality horses you're running against. They might not all be high quality, and I know Inspiral does miss the break, and she did miss the break, but I just think you're setting yourself an unachievable task by sitting stone last in these races, and it was a similar story with King's Gambit. And for King's Gambit to get so close, that was an extraordinary performance. But for me, my unluckiest loser of the week by a mile was Orazio in the Wokingham.
Chris, I wouldn't say he was unlucky, but I reference Vauban on every other edition of this programme, and I still think he's got a massive shot in the Melbourne Cup. Didn't think he stayed the trip in the Gold Cup. In some ways, that's not necessarily a bad thing because it protects his handicap mark. I still think he might win the Melbourne Cup on his second attempt. Anything you want to mention that's less obvious before we move on to the jockeys?
Not an unlucky horse by any means, but I thought Lake Forest did well. Yes. First run of the year to be second in the Commonwealth Cup. Actually a career best on Racing Post ratings. You'd think more to come. Going to be certainly one to follow.
Perfect. Okay, shall we move on to the jockeys then? And Chris, you are going to lead the way on this one.
Yes, give me one second to find my notes because there were a few jockeys involved, weren't they? But I mean, I think probably the big names picked themselves. Oisin Murphy had a fantastic week. Four winners, starting with the Sfura in the big sprint, Running Lion, Wild Tiger in the big handicap, and then Kadem to round off the week. I think DJ described him as doing a Jamie Spencer impression, but maybe if he was doing a full Jamie Spencer impression, he might have been even two or three lengths further back than he was. He showed versatility. I think he's back riding at the peak of his powers. He missed that year and wasn't quite at his best last year, but he is back there now. He's making a difference again. He was having fun. Plus, he went close a couple of times, Tropical Storm in the Norfolk and Kikuli in the Jersey, but got put on Ramatuelle. Again, just an interesting sign again that people are sort of, he's the go-to guy. You know, if you need a local jockey in Britain for your horse, you've decided that the guy who was on your horse, is probably not going to get the job done. They go for Oisin. Exactly that. It didn't make any difference to Ramatuelle, as it turns out. So perhaps we've all, with the full benefit of hindsight, been a tiny bit mean to Aurelien Lemaitre. That didn't work, but he had a great week. I haven't put Ryan as number one because, I was fairly certain that DJ was going to put Aidan as his number one trainer of the week. But he's showed again, why he's generally regarded as the best jockey in the world. He had an amazing time of it. Was it six wins? I've noted them all down here. Illinois, August Rodin. That was a pretty good ride.
Yeah, it was.
Best horse in the race, but he was very effective. Yeah. In the second and third, sort of closing at the end, arguably a tiny bit unlucky, the Zara came in second. But with Ryan, you always feel that you've got quite a good chance of just avoiding that hard luck story. Port Fairy, Kyprios again in the Gold Cup, as inspiring as the horse was, the jockey got the best out of him. Fairy Godmother and Bedtime Story, and of course, again, much may be said there about the difficulties that Fairy Godmother ran into, and Ryan sort of takes the blame on himself, says, she got me out of trouble. But that's the theme with those connections, isn't it? Whenever anything goes wrong, you take all the blame on yourself, I messed up. He says it and Aidan says it. Thank goodness the horse has been able to overcome my shortcomings.
Yeah.
If you took everything they said at face value, you'd think they were a couple of rank incompetents, and that's obviously not the case.
No.
But it's all about building the reputation of these horses, and they're both so very good at it. Ryan, he also went close, didn't he, on Henry Longfellow, obviously, in the St. James's Palace Stakes, as we said, and then Opera Singer as well, who improved for that first run of the year, as so many people expected. It's not all sort of sunshine and roses. Inevitably, if you get lots of high-profile rides, some will end up being a bit disappointing, and so he was on the shortest price run in the whole week, Whistle Jacket in the Norfolk. Hardly his fault, though. I think, reasonably speaking, the betting market was just far too blooming keen on that horse. The idea to me, Again, we're talking with full benefit of hindsight, so you can call this after timing if you like, but making any horse 11 to 10 on for the Norfolk strikes me as
madness.
You know, yeah, it is actual madness.
Yeah.
I think this, the Norfolk has got the worst race for favourites of any race at Royal Ascot. The last winner as favourite was South Central, which is 2008, Howard Johnson trained. So, I mean, that wasn't yesterday.
No.
And this race was won in recent memory by 150 to one shot.
I still think he's a good horse as well, by the way.
He's a really good horse. Yeah. He hadn't run badly at all. I mean, you know, the horses that he raced with up the middle, he beat them all. But
I can see when the Phoenix Stakes next time.
Yeah, well, I don't know about next time. Is there the Anglesey on the way?
Okay.
I'm sure they'll want to give him a run before they go for the...
Yeah.
But yeah, you could easily see him winning that, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Like his brother, Little Big Bear. Yeah. So yeah, he's run a fine race. But I think the group on the far side probably got a better toe into it than he did.
Sure.
And then there was the other horse that flew up the stand side. And they were the ones that finished in front of him. Anyway, so but he's finished unplaced whilst not being beaten very far, 11 to 10 on. There was also River Tiber as well, but he's 13 to 8. But, you know, a bit disappointing, I thought, River Tiber, but maybe circumstances conspired against. The other guy that's slightly less obvious that I wanted to give a good mention to as a jockey had a great week was Colin Keane. He won on Crystal Black in the handicap over a mile and a half, where notoriously now it's really difficult if you've got an inside stall.
Yeah.
You know, you would look at it intuitively and you think, well, you know, an inside stall is an advantage here. But because they go such a quick pace down to Swinley Bottom and they're all fighting for room in the inner, it can actually be, it usually is the wrong place to be. And you're much better off being drawn wide and you get a sort of clear run down to the bottom of the hill and you can, you know, either go forwards if you want or sort of gradually ease over. And you don't have horses all around you sort of setting your mount alight. So, you know, routinely things go wrong for the low-drawn horses. I thought he gave Crystal Black a great ride in a really difficult situation, kept him settled, didn't get trapped on the inside, was very careful, I think, even before the first bend to ease off the rail into the sort of second line of traffic so that when he wanted to make his move around the final bend, he had clear running to do so. He might have been on the best handicapped horse anyway, but he delivered in circumstances where, as I say, things were against him. And I think for jockeys based in Ireland most of the time, Ascot is really difficult because you don't get to take part in the day-to-day meetings where your winning chance is pretty high. You only ever turn up when the racing is at its most competitive, when the fields are all huge. It's really difficult to get a feel for the place. So he doesn't have a great winning record around Ascot because, as I say, he's always turning up when it's sort of fields of 20. And he's, you know, almost never on the best horse. So respect to Colin Keane for delivering on that occasion. I think he only had six rides last week. Other people had tough weeks. You know, inevitably it's going to be the case that, you know, when you've only got so many races and so many horses desperately trying to win them, you know, it's not going to work out for everybody. Holly Doyle didn't get a winner. She's done well at Royal Ascot in recent years. She was beating a nose on a 40 to 1 shot in the Coventry. So she was sort of just on the edge of making it happen, but it didn't quite. And I think she had a couple of other runners up as well. And then there was Alba Shear, probably her shortest priced runner of the week. And the Wokingham just met repeated trouble in running. And Kieran Schumark, I mean, it would have been great if he could have got something out of his week. There was Inspiral, apart from her, I don't know if he had any that were sort of really obvious chances, but he had quite a few rides and it didn't quite happen. And Cat Ninja fancied for the Sandringham as well, but ran too free. It just feels like Kieran, and you've got to be careful about projecting emotions onto jockeys, but I think a high profile win now that he's riding regularly for the Gosdens and people are watching him because he's sort of inherited Frankie's mantle, that would do his confidence no end of good, and it probably can't come soon enough. And you know, if that was to happen, then you might see things flowing a bit more easily from that point. Just at the moment, I wonder if he's maybe short of a little bit of confidence, but it's a high profile job to be dropped into when you're not used to being in the high profile job every Saturday. So, you know, I wish him well.
DJ, talking about confidence, two jockeys whose confidence must be very, very high after last week, Billy Loughnan and Callum Shepherd.
Yeah, absolutely. I have the I'll credit you. We're doing, I think, Ride of the Week, Performance of the Week, Trainer of the Week. I think Article of the Week will probably go to Lee Mottershead for his piece on Callum Shepherd, which I'd like to say I had a hand in, given I proofread it afterwards.
He's very good as well. Ruthless.
Pointed out the 2.3 million mistakes.
Ruthless.
Well done, DJ.
But it was a terrific piece, and it was like, you managed to kind of put into words, I think, what we were all feeling, and just the whole... The fact that he was watching Grey's Anatomy in a car park at Lingfield when the Derby was on, and Ambie and Friendly was absolutely tanking 2 furlongs out. Like, it just all brought it home to see the difference between having a big ride in the race, in a big race, the biggest race, and not having a ride on a fancy runner in the biggest race and being at a different meeting or whatever. It's just astonishing. And, you know, I know... We can say, what else is he going to do? He's not going to throw the toys out of the pram. But it's just, it is nice to see seemingly a really nice guy handling a situation really well, and then kind of karma helping him out and coming back and saying, well, you know what? You did well there. Here you go. Well done. And a big race win at Royal Ascot. And it was terrific on I Love Jura. And if anybody hasn't read the piece, I'd advise you to write the piece. Read the piece. Terrific read. And then, obviously, Billy Loughnan. Sure, he's just deadly, isn't he? he's just like, you watch him and you kind of go, when they turn 16 and there's a big kind of buzz around jockeys, it can often be the case where they'll do really well for like a certain amount of time, and then it becomes real and you lose your claim and it all gets a bit serious and some will sink and some will swim. He's like... He's Olympic swimming, like he's having 2 winners at Royal Ascot. And I just put on Soprano. Like, Soprano was a filly who I never thought might stay a mile, and he rode her with such confidence and was so stylish in the finish. Like, it kind of reminded me a little bit of the day Harry Cobden won on Top of the Game in the RSA, as it was then. It was kind of like, it was a big race ride for a relatively young and inexperienced jockey. But when they actually got into the situation, it was so normal to them. And I remember on Top of the Game, Harry almost, eased off 5 yards from the line because he knew he had won. And it was a similar story with Billy Loughnan. It was kind of 10 yards from the line. He knew he was getting there. And while she only won by a half a length or a neck or whatever it was like, I know what I'm doing here. I'm meant to be here. I'm meant to be riding at the business end of these races. And I just think he's deadly, and I hope he goes far. I just want to give a shout out to two. Just on Ryan Moore, if you're... I'm going to try and phrase this right, okay? Ryan Moore always wins on horses he should win on. And I think this is his biggest asset. He always wins on horses he should win on, and he probably doesn't win on horses he shouldn't. And I'm going to try and make sense of that, in that you have just said Ryan, who always has the horse in the right place at the right time for a fancy horse. So he's taken luck out of the equation. So you look at Auguste Rodin, you look at Illinois... You look at all his fancy runners, apart from Fairy Godmother, where circumstances conspired against him. But I think he takes luck over. Whereas if he was riding, just say, I'll give you an example. I personally don't think Ryan Moore would have won on Caddam in the Jubilee Stakes on Saturday, because I don't think he would have ridden Caddam like that. I think Ryan's biggest asset, and what will make him go down in the history books as one of the greatest jockeys of all time, is that he has this ability to say, right, if this horse is good enough, I'm going to give you the best chance of winning the race. If you're not good enough, that's your own fault. And that's what I think makes Ryan so good. So shout out to Ryan. I don't even know if that makes sense. Maybe I got caught in trying to explain it. But the other shout I want to give to is James Doyle and Hatem. Winning a race where he could have lost it. So Hatem, we all thought, would be vulnerable over 7. But he didn't force it early. He didn't make the run, and he didn't go too fast too soon. He held on to his horse. He made his challenge at the right time, and he was strong on the finish. So that was a ride that he could have won or could have lost with the minorest little percentage of error. I thought he was absolutely fantastic. There you go.
Can I give a few more mentions out, just so that no one can say we've left
absolutely
significant people out? William Buick had 2 even with, got off and having a tough week.
Yeah.
Tom Markman, 2 winners. Sean Levy also 2 winners. And also, I'd like to mention Rachel King, who sort of, she got plenty of media, but I think in terms of, you know, people who are actually employing jockeys to do the riding, she was still sailing a bit below the radar. Yeah. So this is a British girl who went to Australia about 11 years ago because she wasn't getting any chances here. Got chances there and made rapid progress and is now winning top class races over there. Came back to England to get married at the weekend and thought she'd make a sort of working week of it and see if she could get some rides at Royal Ascot. You know what it's like in that situation. We imagine what it's like in that situation. You want to prove your newfound skills to your old mates back in England, where you're from. And she only got two rides. I was a bit disappointed for her. Of course, everybody has their established jockeys, and they want to reward them when the big show comes along. But I would have liked British racing and Irish racing, maybe collectively, to have had enough imagination to give her a couple more chances. As it was, she went pretty close in the Sandringham on strutting. The other horse she rode, I think, was disappointing. Yes, that's right. It just sort of dropped out the back. She very nearly got a win from two chances. It's just great that she was here and great that she got one decent attempt and went close, and I hope she enjoyed it. But like I say, it would have been good to see her get a few more chances. Of course, there's always a lot of jockeys that you could say that about.
Well, she'll be getting married this time next year, but let us hope she returns. Right, part three then of the front page, and we're going to be looking now at the top trainers and the owners who made a mark, or maybe didn't make a mark, at the Royal Meeting. David Jennings.
Yes, sure, obviously Aidan, leading trainer at the meeting 13 times now. I always have trouble saying 13 to get my THs sorted. 13 times. Look, he was 1-4 at the start of the week to be top trainer. I think that probably was a little bit of value. It certainly is now. I didn't think it was at the time, actually. I thought John Taylor Gosden might give him a run for his money, but they didn't. Just having horses ready to rock at the biggest kind of week of the year, that's what he's good at. Didn't start particularly well. I don't think they had a winner on the opening day. Obviously, you're kind of thinking, is it going to be one of those weeks? And I think probably a worrying aspect for them would be maybe the two-year-old colts. Camille Pissarro didn't look anything out of the ordinary. In fact, he looked distinctly ordinary, I thought, in the Coventry. And then he had a couple of other kind of fancied runners in some of the other kind of the Windsor Castle that were disappointing as well. And the fillies, obviously, you know, flew the flag for the two-year-olds. I would say with Whistle Jacket, according to Aidan anyway, and it certainly looked that way. I watched that race, that Whistle Jacket race, and afterwards I turned around. I can't remember who I was watching beside, Bill Esdale or somebody. And I turned around and I said, oh my God, Whistle Jacket's ran an absolute shocker, hasn't he? And kind of didn't think any more of it. Went down to Bradering, got my quotes, came back up, and then I started watching the race again. I said, oh my God, he's only been beaten like 3/4 of a length. See, when they were passing us in the grandstand, he was, you know, the first horse under pressure, and he looked like he was really struggling. And then he found his second wind. And listened to Aidan afterwards. I asked him about the performance. I said, what do you make the performance of Whistle Jacket? He said, he was after running on soft ground, and he had ran over 6, obviously, on his debut. And to go from that kind of quality of a race to a really top race over 5 on rattling fast ground, he just thought it was a bit of a shock to the system for Whistle Jacket. So I think Whistle Jacket is still a very good colt, but you would have a little bit of concern over the Ballydoyle 2-year-old colts at this stage. They definitely don't have a City of Troy. It looks like so far they don't have a Henry Longfellow just yet, but obviously we're only in the middle of June, so there's loads and loads of time for that to change. Augusto then is interesting. I asked him for his performance of the week afterwards on Saturday after he had his 6 winners, and what was his highlight? And without even hesitating whatsoever, it was Augusto then. Just the fact that he did it, and he's, you know, come back to what we know he can probably do. I think Aidan got huge satisfaction out of that. can you trust him again? I don't know. Can we trust him full time now? He probably needs soft ground or fast ground, and probably needs to be ridden prominently. So I don't think you'll ever see Auguste Rodin running on soft ground or being held up ever again. So maybe we might see a bit of consistency with Auguste Rodin now. But obviously a terrific training performance by Aidan, top trainer. So we'd have to put him in the number one slot. Brian Meehan has to go in there. 5 runners, 2 winners. I grew up just watching Brian Meehan horses and thinking he was a brilliant trainer. So it's great to see Brian back in the big time. And I just love the way he even spoke about Sean Levy afterwards, just saying that he is a big time jockey and he's well capable of winning big races at the biggest meetings. And I kind of like that when he kind of shared the jockey with praise and wasn't just taking it all himself. So terrific training performance from Brian Meehan. Richard Hannon, have to give a shout out to, have to have him in the top three, probably Rosalian and Hatem. They have completely flown the flag for the stable this season. 2 terrific 3-year-olds, and I was just delighted Hatem won, because he's one of them horses who was such a good 2-year-old. He's a better 3-year-old, but we kind of go, it's only Hatem. And you know, it was a big call to run him in the Jersey. Probably an easy call, it's an easier race, but he's still running against River Tiber, and he's still one of the highest quality jerseys we've seen in quite a while, and it had a big feel as well. So it was a big call, so kudos to him for doing that. And the final one I'll mention, probably in joint third, would be Carol Burke, who has just been a revelation this season and last season and the season before, and just taken the quality of his yard to a whole new dimension. Shareholder was extremely impressive. Just looked top-notch, like to travel, to quicken, to win. I'd say Shareholder is very, very good. And you just know the way Carol talks about Shareholder suggests that's the case. So there you go. There's a few trainers for you, Lee.
Plenty there, DJ. Chris, Carl Burke referenced there by DJ. Part of a good week, or a very good week again for the North, and in particular for Yorkshire. With loads of winners coming from Yorkshire yards.
And other horses running well as well. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Again, what interest there is it within that northern sort of racing, flat racing division, there's definitely been a change in the balance of power. It's now Kevin Ryan, Carl Burke, Richard Fye to an extent as well. Whereas once upon a time it would always have been the Johnson team that led the way in the north. Not so much the case at the moment. And just one interesting little stat, it was the first time in 25 years that the Johnsons hadn't had a runner in the King George the Fifth Handicap. They've won it plenty, often had multiple runners. This year they had the reserve, didn't quite get in. It feels like there's been a change in the north.
There literally has been a change at that yard. You know,
absolutely,
Charlie's got the license now. They had a dozen runners and didn't get involved. Sometimes these things happen, you know, 1 year or 2 years can go against you. You know, there were years in the past when Mark wouldn't be able to get involved, particularly at Royal Ascot, but you know, you wouldn't want to see that continuing. I think the yard is still going strong, you know, in the trainers' table. So, you know, maybe it's just a blip. But I mean, we published some stats about Yorkshire's success at Royal Ascot in the paper today, and it was quite impressive. You know, it's going back more than 20 years where there'd be at least one winner from Yorkshire at Royal Ascot. You know, that somebody said there's no north-south divide in flat racing. And there might be a bit of fighting talk mixed in there, but it's basically the case. You know, there are some very big, powerful stables in the north, and big-time owners seem to have no problem in trusting their horses to trainers based there.
Big week as well for a lot of young trainers. Obviously, Donica O'Brien won the Coronation Stakes. George Scott, George Bowie, Harry Charlton, Ed Walker, Ed Bethel, all among the winners, which is a pleasing thing to see.
Yeah, we've got to give these young guys some encouragement, right? And they'll probably think the game's easy and be surprised when they come back next year and can't immediately build on that. But very pleasing, and some really promising young trainers that you've mentioned in there as well. I love the sort of the fact that you've got a broad cast of potential winners when you get to these major meetings. The issue in jump racing is that cast is sort of narrowed to a point, and that takes a lot of the colour and the drama out of it. But you know, Royal Ascot, no problem there.
In terms of finding winners, actually, it helped if you just picked out horses owned by Wathen Racing, who in their second year had an extraordinary run of success, which highlights the work done by those people sourcing the horses, both horses in training and breeze up purchases, yielding purchases, interior purchases, Richard Brand, the team there. They did incredibly well, as of course we know Coolmore did through Ballydoyle, but the contrast is Godolphin, who for the second consecutive year had a poor Royal Ascot, one winner, Sybin Sir Train winner of the Royal Hunt Cup, nothing for Charlie Appleby. And numbers-wise as well, Wathden had 28 Royal Ascot runners, Godolphin had only 12. 12 Godolphin runners during Royal Ascot seems like a very small number.
It absolutely does, and I'm not clear at all what's gone wrong there. I mean, part of the factor may be that, you know, Sheikh Mohammed doesn't turn up at the races in Britain these days. So maybe if you know that he's not going to be there, there's not quite the same pressure to produce horses that are going to be competitive for him to watch while he's there. We know that, you know, Charlie Appleby is still extremely effective. He's got a team of horses in the US, hasn't he? Doing very well. He did take the Guineas winner to Royal Ascot, in fairness, and, you know, on another day, Notable Speech might have got involved in the finish. Horse who lost her unbeaten record, whose name escaped, was it Diamond?
Diamond Rain.
Yeah.
Who ran last in the Ribblesdale.
I mean, that was a disappointing effort, slice it where you will. But these things can happen. The numbers, as you say, perplexing, but, you know, they've still got plenty of talented horses, and maybe they're saving them for the July meeting.
Yeah, they might well be. Before we end the programme, while we're talking about top level flat racing, we should reference the news that it was announced yesterday that Kipco is going to continue its sponsorship of British Champions Day and its commercial partnership with Ascot for another 2 years, which will take them through to 2026. They have decided to relinquish their sponsorship, or they are relinquishing their sponsorship of the July Cup, the Two Guineas and British Champions Series as a vehicle. My understanding is that Kipco came to a decision it wanted to spend less going forward. These are obviously difficult financial times for a lot of commercial organisations, and that ultimately a decision between Kipco and Racing was that it would be best to concentrate that money on Champions Day in particular, and give Newmarket and Ascot the vehicle to find new sponsors for the Guineas and the King George. And suggestions are that maybe Newmarket might not be that far off announcing something in relation to the Guineas. Chris, what did you make of this news yesterday?
So the sport's got to be grateful for the enormous sum of money that they've had off Kipco over the years.
And it is a huge sponsorship, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's also one that they're not like an organisation where you're going to buy a Kipco coat, a Kipco brolly, a Kipco bag.
No, there's literally nothing in it for them.
No.
It's a sort of, what would you call it, philanthropy.
Yeah.
You're basically giving money away. As I say, the right attitude is to be grateful for what you've had, but at the same time, there's naturally going to be a concern about, you know, having to replace a really big-time blue-chip sponsor for, some very important, well-funded races. The number of sort of potentials who might sign up for races like that, you know, it's a short one. And so it always does kind of bother me when one of our big-time flat races falls vacant. Because you basically got to find somebody who isn't just going to say, well, what's in it for me? You know, because we know perfectly well, in terms of media profile, a really big flat race isn't all that far ahead of some other race that they might sponsor for much less money and still get something out of it. You know, if you want a day at the races and, you know, take some of your staff or your customers, there's lots of races that would do. You don't have to go shelling out for a race like the King George or the 2000 Guineas. That is going to be difficult, and we keep our fingers crossed. You know, there's enormous prestige there. You'd have the knowledge if you signed up of supporting a sort of historic sport that's important to Britain. But are you going to be able to tell your shareholders that you're getting $2 back for every dollar you're spending on a sponsorship like that? I don't know.
Yeah, I half wonder. Betfred already have the Derby, the Oaks and the St. Ledger.
You think they're going to go for the set?
They might have a clean sweep of the class. That's
just that might appeal to Fred, you know, who knows?
But you imagine the bookmakers either way will be, in the current market, they might well be the obvious place to go for sponsorships.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope we're past the days of being sniffy bookmakers just because they're bookmakers.
Because they certainly activate sponsorships, so they actually promote and they push.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully that you know their execs understand the sport and love it and want to support it. So, yeah, that's got obvious potential.
Yeah, well, you would imagine that both Newmarket and Ascot will be actively looking if they haven't found anything already. Okay, that then, I think, brings us to the end of this week's edition. David, thanks ever for your contribution and your hard work. You had some long days last week.
Yeah, we do show at 8 o'clock every morning. It was great fun. The good morning shows are always great fun. Up very early, up at 5 o'clock most days, and but I always think like when you start complaining about working at Royal Ascot, it's time to give the game up because there are far worse jobs than to be working at Royal Ascot. So I felt very privileged, and we great fun, great week, and it's one of those weeks where you're kind of proud of the sport, where you kind of go, this is one thing we do exceptionally well. Like everything is done so brilliantly, and it's such an occasion, and yes, there's a lot of money flaunted around, and yes, it's high-end stuff, but it's just one week we do terrifically, terrifically well. So well done to all at Ascot.
Yeah, well done, and in particular from our point of view, well done, and thanks to Maureen and Jan, who look after the main press room at Ascot and do a fantastic job doing that as well. Chris, you enjoyed the week, obviously.
Yeah, great time.
And all being well, we'll do it all again next year. More immediately, we'll have another edition of The Front Page next week. Until then, thanks for watching and bye-bye.